Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the First World War and have around 6,000 members worldwide. For more information, visit our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 15th of November, 2024, and this is episode 345. On today's Mentioned in Dispatches podcast, I talked to Dr. Stephanie Linden about her new book, Beyond the Great Silence, The Legacy of Shell Shock in Britain and Germany, 1918 to 1924. Stephanie is a psychiatrist, but also a historian of psychiatry. She has worked in mental health services in Germany and the United Kingdom and has completed a PhD on the history of shell shock from King's College London. Her original PhD was the basis of her 2017 book, They Called It Shell Shocked, which was published by Helion. She's currently a lecturer at the Department of Ethics, Society and Health at Maastricht University and an honorary research fellow at Cardiff University. She spoke to me from her home in the Netherlands. Stephanie, welcome back to the podcast. This is your second time, I believe. Just for our listeners, could you just recap about who you are and how you became interested in the Great War and shell shock?
Yes, hello, Tom. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm a psychiatrist and historian of psychiatry. I worked in mental health services in Germany and the United Kingdom, and I completed a PhD on shell shock at King's College London, which was the basis for my book, They Called It Shell Shock, also published with Helion. At the moment, I am a lecturer in the Department of Health, Ethics and Society at Maastricht University, and I'm also an honorary research fellow at Cardiff University. So, thank you so much for having me, and I'm looking forward to hearing your question.
Now, the first couple, I know this might need going back over probably what you've covered in the previous one, but what exactly is shell shock, and what exactly was meant by it during the Great War?
So shell shock was the iconic reaction of World War I soldiers to combat stress. It was characterized by neurological impairments, for example, gait disturbance, paralysis, or inability to speak, but a wide variety of bodily and psychological symptoms could occur. Anxiety and depression, pain and fatigue were also very common. In its origin, shell shock implied that exploding shells with their pressure waves caused damage to the brain and spinal cord, resulting in a wide range of nervous symptoms. Indeed, most soldiers developed symptoms after a shell explosion or burial at the front. Shell explosions led to a sudden loss of physical and mental control. Most soldiers regained control of their limbs and senses within hours or days, but some suffered chronic disabilities. Later during the war, most experts believed that it was more the psychological rather than the direct physical impact of the explosions. One reason was that symptoms of shell shock occurred in recruits who had never been exposed to combat. Another reason was that psychological therapies, for example, hypnosis, were very successful.
How common was shell shock? What was its sort of prevalence among soldiers in the Great War?
So there are estimates that 80,000 soldiers of the British Army suffered from shell shock, and we can probably assume similar proportions, 2%, for the other combatant nations as well. However, at the start of the war, it was not clear at all how far this epidemic would go. Authorities feared that even larger parts of their combat forces could be affected, seriously threatening their military capacity. We are probably most familiar with cases of bizarre gait patterns and violent shaking, like those documented in the famous war film of Arthur Hearst, but the most common symptoms were less dramatic and less visible: chronic pain and fatigue, depression, anxiety, and sleep disturbances.
So how did medical authorities initially diagnose and treat shell shock during the war? And how did these treatments and therapies change over the course of the war?
So you must remember that they did not have any brain imaging techniques at their disposal. All they could do is perform an X-ray of the skull, which does not reveal much beyond helping to exclude a fracture. They thus had to rely on their skills at clinical history taking and neurological examination in order to determine whether someone presenting with motor or sensory dysfunction was suffering from a specific brain disorder, such as multiple sclerosis. Similarly, for the many cases of seizures, they did not have electroencephalography, which was only invented in the 1920s to distinguish between epileptic and psychogenic non-epileptic seizures. Again, they had to rely on clinical acumen alone. Some diseases, however, could already be diagnosed by laboratory tests, for example, syphilis. Shell shock was thus primarily diagnosed if available tests did not suggest another neurological cause, and if clinical history strongly suggested a link with a combat experience. Shell shock was not the only term for disorders suspected to be of psychological origin. Others were neurasthenia or hysteria. After the war, though, British physicians tended to attach organic labels like epilepsy or multiple sclerosis to cases that during the war years would clearly have received a psychological label. One reason may have been the push to reduce the number of veterans who could claim a pension for war-related injuries. You also asked about treatment. Treatment also evolved during the war. Electrotherapy was employed relatively early on. It had already been part of the therapeutic arsenal for civilian cases of hysteria since the 19th century. Over the war years, psychological treatments also became prominent, for example, hypnosis or different forms of talking therapies. We also see the first formal follow-up studies in psychiatry. The most impressive study on shell shock was conducted by Norman Fenton, an American physician who went to France to study war neurosis in American soldiers. All soldiers he had been treated in a specialized neuropsychiatric hospital at La Fouche, which could accommodate 1,200 patients. Fenton mainly wanted to explore how shell-shocked soldiers reintegrated into society upon their return to America after the war. He contacted ex-servicemen through the mail and asked them to fill in questionnaires, first in 1919-20 and again in 1924. Veterans were also invited for interviews in person or over the phone. Through all these methods, Fenton obtained data from 758 former patients.
Now we're coming to the obviously the real focus of your book, the post-war period in Germany and Britain. You actually discuss how the differing approaches to the management of these conditions by the medical authorities after the First World War. Could you tell us about how they differed in Germany and Britain, and how they actually looked after these people in the early 1920s?
So I looked at the medical records of the National Hospital at Queen Square in London and the Charité in Berlin. Thus, we are talking about leading academic centers in the capitals of key powers. However, there were obviously major differences. Germany had been defeated, and Berlin was in the grip of chaos and revolution for the first months after the armistice. Britain was one of the victors, but of course, the political and economic outcomes were ambiguous at best. Both sides thus had to deal with their own challenges, particularly when it came to reintegrating veterans. It is remarkable that the Charité pretty much kept operating without interruption throughout all the political upheavals. The Charité doctors labeled the vast majority of traumatized soldiers as psychopaths. This implied that they were affected by an inborn weakness which had predisposed them to collapsing under the pressure of combat and absolved the state from its responsibility. These veterans generally were not recommended for a pension. By labeling patients as psychopaths or constitutionally inferior, psychiatrists became moral judges who could destroy a man's reputation and thwart his psychological and economic recovery. Furthermore, by establishing that an inherent psychopathic constitution, but not the war, was responsible for the symptoms, psychiatrists deprived their patients not only of a pension, but also of the recognition of their war trauma. The Queen Square doctors also showed a growing tendency to cut the link between the patient's condition and the war experience. As I already mentioned, it is striking how often they provided diagnosis of classical neurological disorders such as multiple sclerosis in cases with clear psychological causation. At least they did not put the blame on the patient's constitution as the Charité doctors did, but either way, the pension was denied. By labeling traumatized men as psychopaths, as commonly done in Germany, or by attaching somatic labels to their symptoms, as done in Britain, the medical profession cut the link between the war and the enduring suffering. In that way, veterans who had sacrificed their physical and mental health for their country were deprived of the recognition that their suffering was a direct result of their war service.
So, how did the medical systems in Britain and Germany differ in their treatment and support of shell shock veterans after the armistice?
So, although the British and German governments recognized the need to rehabilitate and reintegrate their returning veterans and acknowledged the state's responsibility, the support systems for disabled servicemen in both countries differed considerably. Germany had a very good insurance and rehabilitation system for injured veterans, which in principle also included those with psychological injuries, if they could get recognized. In post-war Germany, treatment and rehabilitation were seen as main priorities. The primary goal was to return the soldier to his old employment, or if this was not possible, to train him for a new profession. By law, most German employers were required to hire the war disabled, and it was extremely difficult to dismiss a disabled veteran. Even severely disabled veterans had to be reintegrated into the country's workforce. Furthermore, pensions in Germany were relatively generous and compensated men for their loss of earning capacity as well as for their physical disabilities. In contrast, Britain compensated her ex-servicemen with only modest pensions, and these were solely based on the degree of physical disfigurement or illness, not taking the man's earning capacity into consideration. In the late 1920s, Germany spent over 20% of her annual budget on war pensions. In Britain, it was about 7%. Although in Britain, provisions from the state were much more patchy, there was a great tradition of philanthropy. Some, but not all, charitable rehabilitation schemes were opened for mentally disabled veterans. One exemplary initiative, which accepted veterans with so-called shattered nerves, was the Enham Project. Enham Village was established in 1919 at Enham Park and Place in Hampshire. The project offered a countryside retreat for 1,000 disabled servicemen. It was made possible with a grant from the British Red Cross Society and further support by the Ministry of Pensions. The estate covered over 1,000 acres of land and contained houses, farms, a village hall, post office, smithy, and over 20 cottages. Disabled men could be trained in carpentry, furniture and bootmaking, tailoring, motor repairing, building, painting, and plumbing. At the same time, they benefited from medical treatment and rehabilitation. Men with families were offered the opportunity to acquire their own house and a piece of land so that they could work towards their economic independence.
I wonder whether we could turn to some of the experiences of veterans. Could you share some personal stories of shell shock soldiers from your research and how their experiences differed in Germany and Britain?
Yeah, in the past 15 years, I tried to find differences between British and German soldiers' experience of World War I. I looked at circumstances and triggers of breakdown, expressions of distress, and the cause of symptoms. The longer I looked, the more I realized that there are more commonalities than differences between the suffering of British and German soldiers. Perhaps the differences become more apparent after the war when soldiers return different countries, the British as the victors and the Germans as the vanquished. So each traumatized soldier, British or German, has his own story of suffering, a story which did not end with the cessation of fighting or discharge from the army. But indeed, some stories left a particularly strong impression on me. One story that comes to my mind is about a young German soldier. I call him Louis in the book. Louis was an aspiring actor when the war started. He attended drama school in Berlin, but was soon drafted into the army. In September 1914, he was sent into battle. 3 months later, he was wounded. At a military base, he received his first injection of morphine, which eased his physical and mental suffering. Over the next 4 weeks, Louis was given regular injections of morphine. He was then transferred to a military hospital in Frankfurt. As soon as he was allowed to leave the hospital, he procured a shot of morphine. He injected himself regularly and steadily increased the dose. In the following years, Louis underwent many detoxification treatments at specialist hospitals. On every occasion, he suffered excruciating withdrawal symptoms. However, he always relapsed straight after discharge from these institutions. He also consumed cocaine and drank huge amounts of alcohol, sometimes even pure ether. All these substances were widely available in Berlin, either in pharmacies or on the black market. To put an end to this vicious circle, Louis embarked on two long sea journeys on merchant ships, one which set sail for Southeast America. The sudden withdrawal caused pure agony, but Louis persevered, exhausting himself with hard physical labor. When he arrived back in Hamburg on the 15th of March 1924, he had pulled through the worst withdrawal symptoms. This time, he resisted the temptation of getting his next shot and managed to refrain from taking drugs from then onwards. We have evidence through the documentation of the Charité that Louis succeeded with his self-enforced cure. I found many similar cases in the Charité archives. These veterans who had endured fighting at the front and were wounded returned from the war as addicts. For me, this was one of the unexpected findings from the archives, and this problem seems to have been more prevalent among German soldiers. These addicted veterans were some of the forgotten victims of the war. Would you like to hear a British case as well?
Yes, that would be great.
Among all the post-war cases, that of Morris comes to my mind. In his early 20s, Morris was in Palestine in January 1918. I have a quote here from the case record. He was transporting small arms up to the front trenches and sleeping at night in holes and caverns in the rocks. One night, after attending to the mules, he went to the cave to which he thought his comrade had gone. He felt in the dark that someone was lying down on the floor. Thinking it was his comrade asleep, he lay down beside him. In the morning, he woke up with the sun coming into the cave to find that he had been lying beside a dead Turk all night. The Turk had only been dead a short time and his head was all bashed in. This was a great shock, and Morris staggered towards the entrance of the cave and struck his head. He blacked out, and on regaining consciousness, he found his sight was gone completely. It remained absent for 5 days. Morris recovered his eyesight completely, and he even won the lightweight boxing championship of the forces in Egypt in April 1918. Around that time, he contracted malaria and was sent home. After demobilization, Morris's visual troubles returned regularly. Sometimes he lost his sight completely, sometimes he saw double or treble, or objects were moving in front of his eyes. Morris also began to have a dead, lifeless feeling in his body. Years after the end of the war, Morris was still struggling with his eyes. There was no physical explanation for his troubles. This case, like many others, shows that some soldiers never recovered from their war trauma. Their war experiences were so overwhelming that they lost their senses, both literally and figuratively speaking. The loss of vision often seemed to be the direct consequence of witnessing violence, destruction, and death. It was as if the body tried to put up a protective shield against a sight too painful to bear. Although these cases are all about breakdown and suffering, they also attest to a remarkable resilience. These men had to go through the horrors of war. They witnessed death and destruction. Their bodies were starved and mutilated, and yet they managed to survive and return into a civilian world which had changed during their often prolonged absence.
Now, I wonder whether we could examine the impact of this war trauma on the wider society. How did it affect civilians, especially those in the families of veterans who return, especially their wives or their children or their other relatives?
Indeed, the war had a huge impact on civilians. The most traumatizing experience for British civilians was certainly the German bombardment of seaside towns and cities, first with zeppelins and later with aeroplanes. Although the authorities generally denied that these attacks caused panic among the civilian population, many men, women, and children had to be treated for air raid shock. These stress reactions really looked like shell shock, with civilians developing severe anxiety attacks, shaking uncontrollably, or wandering around in a semi-conscious state. In some air raids, or even the air raid warnings, triggered seizures or panic attacks. As with shell-shocked soldiers, sounds reminiscent of the traumatizing experience could always trigger further breakdowns. The war caused further stresses for the civilian population. I do not need to mention the food shortages, economic hardship, and uncertainty most people faced in a time of war. Although women were not in danger of being drafted into the army, they often had to face the absence of their fathers, brothers, husbands, and sons for military service. The departure of their husbands was deeply traumatizing for many women, and I've found several cases of women who broke down after their husband's departure and developed symptoms which resembled those of shell-shocked soldiers. For mothers, the thought of losing their sons in battle was the worst imaginable nightmare. There were many cases of fathers who committed suicide when they heard of the untimely death of their sons. The war produced between 3 and 4 million widows. In 1920, there were 525,000 war widows in Germany and 240,000 in Great Britain. Those wives who were lucky enough that their husbands returned from the war were faced with other unforeseen challenges. As I described in my book, many men were almost unrecognizable to their families. Some had mutilated bodies, they had suffered facial injuries, had lost an arm or a leg, were riddled with disease, or had simply turned into old men. Much worse for many of them were the often invisible psychological scars the war had left. These men were haunted by nightmares, unable to shake off the gruesome memories of war. Their wives welcomed them home, but the years of separation had often taken their toll. War had estranged the couples because each of them had fought a very different battle. After years of coping without their husbands, women certainly craved for a strong shoulder to lean on, a partner by their side, and a father for their children. However, the men who returned from war were often shadows of their former selves. Women often had to take the initiative to apply for their husbands' war pensions. It was the women who organized treatment and rehabilitation for their husbands, who talked to employers to get their men back into work. It was the women who held their families together and made ends meet. In Berlin, it was often the wives who put pressure on doctors to acknowledge the damage war had inflicted on their husbands' bodies and minds. Many of the husbands, who often could not speak for themselves, had lost their purpose and direction in life. Many were irritable, aggressive, and resorted to alcohol or drugs. Thus, the consequences of war affected soldiers and civilians in many ways and transformed their lives and that of the next generation.
I wonder whether we could look at the cultural and social responses to shell shock. How did the attitudes of the wider society towards people who had suffered shell shock differ between Germany and Britain? And also, probably what I should also say is, what were their similarities as well?
British and German soldiers returned to very different countries, the British as the victors, the Germans as the vanquished. In Germany, mentally disabled war veterans were the outcasts of society. They were the unpleasant reminders of a lost war and a burden to the overstrained welfare state. War neurotics had the reputation of being work shy, lazy, and unreliable. The Charité doctors labeled them as pensioner neurotics who were clinging to their symptoms in order to secure a comfortable living. Not only the medical system discredited shell shock sufferers and dismissed their pleas for recognition and support, the fact that the war disabled were prioritized on the job market by German disability law enraged fellow countrymen and co-workers. Employers naturally preferred able-bodied men or women who were cheaper, compliant, and had often already replaced men during the war years. Physically disabled veterans also thought that shell shock sufferers jumped the queue. Those with physical injuries considered themselves to be more deserving of a job and financial support. In Britain, the standing of shell shock soldiers was different, although German veterans were certainly better cared for by their government and enjoyed more generous pension payments and disability support. The British achieved a better integration of veterans into society than Germany. Philanthropic enterprises and charitable events showed that the British cared about their war disabled and wanted them back as active members of society. The commitment of the British people to their war disabled reconciled the veteran community with their country. Furthermore, war monuments, remembrance services, and other commemorative events in Britain, which were widely supported by the state and the general public, reminded veterans that they were honored and respected for their service. Conversely, Germany's lack of charitable initiatives, partly due to state restrictions on private fundraising and philanthropic enterprises, filled the veterans' community with bitterness and resentment. There was no public display of appreciation and gratitude, no tribute to those who had risked their lives for the country and lost everything. Although disabled German veterans were reintegrated into the country's workforce, they felt that their fellow citizens resented their right to a job. The rift between German war veterans and the public deepened when inflation and economic crisis left many able-bodied men without jobs and savings. Essentially, state-enforced reemployment for the war disabled failed because nobody really stood behind it. As a bitter consequence, the men who should have appreciated the generous pension system, retraining programs, and preferential allocation of jobs turned against the state. So ultimately, reintegration was more successful in Britain than in Germany. Britain certainly had the advantage of a narrative of victory in which veterans had risked their lives for the cause of justice and freedom. This narrative may have made it easier to motivate charitable initiatives that became a matter of national pride. Thus, it is not clear whether the British path would have been open to Germany, which instead invested heavily in a pension system it could barely afford.
And my penultimate question looks at the legacy of shell shock. In what ways has the concept of shell shock transcended its original meaning, and how does this continue to influence our understanding of war trauma today?
Shell shock has, of course, become a term of popular culture separated from the war experience. There is, however, a deeper sense in which the debates around shell shock during World War I and its aftermath are relevant to our understanding of war trauma today. Although the majority view in both Britain and Germany was that shell shock was essentially a psychological consequence of war trauma, the doctors of the time were not entirely comfortable with this concept. The quest for organic causes continued. Frederick Walker Mott, an eminent British neuropathologist and authority on shell shock, continued his search for brain alterations in shell shock victims throughout and beyond the war. Other researchers conducted animal experiments on the traumatic effects of shell explosions on the brain. We see similar tendencies today in the debate around mild traumatic brain injury of veterans. Are the often long-term consequences caused by physical injury to the brain or by psychological reactions to the traumatic experience, or a combination of both? The debate continues. As a medical term, shell shock went out of fashion. The medical world agreed that the term was inappropriate and that it should be officially banned from medical terminology. In the case records of the National Hospital, shell shock disappeared towards the end of the war, but the term was still used by patients to explain their symptoms. However, shell shock could not be banned from public use. With the term shell shock, the British created a perfect term which captured the unimaginable terror of the Great War. Shell shock has become part of the lived experience of a nation. The Germans did not create a comparable term. There was no collective remembering, but a fading into oblivion. In Germany, war neurosis got immersed in the great silence. The nightmares, flashbacks, strange movements, and stutters remained. They became part of civilian life.
Where can people get their hands on your book?
Well, you can most easily get it from the Helion website, but it should also be available from most online booksellers.
And on that bombshell, Stephanie, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS21. 95. Until next time.